Let's talk about two security stories that landed today with quite different profiles. The GPS signal tampering satellite data from space.com is the kind of story that starts as a known problem and becomes alarming when you quantify it properly. GPS spoofing, transmitting false GPS signals to mislead receivers, has been documented for years, particularly in conflict zones and areas of geopolitical tension. But a satellite-based study of the phenomenon revealed that the scale of active tampering is, in the researchers' own words, quite a bit more than we expected.
The technical mechanism matters here. GPS signals are extremely weak by the time they reach the Earth's surface. They travel from satellites roughly 20,000 kilometers away and arrive at power levels far below ambient radio noise. This is why GPS receivers work at all. They use spread spectrum techniques and correlation to extract signal from noise. But the weakness of the signal means that a relatively modest terrestrial transmitter broadcasting a false GPS signal can overwhelm receivers in a wide area. The spoofing isn't hypothetical interference. It's deliberate geographic manipulation, making receivers think they're somewhere they're not.
The implications extend well beyond navigation. Modern financial infrastructure uses GPS timestamps for transaction ordering. Aviation safety systems rely on GPS position. Precision agriculture, autonomous vehicle systems, emergency services dispatch, the dependency tree on accurate GPS is extensive and often invisible until it breaks. The HN comment thread is discussing the detection approaches that the satellite study used, and several security researchers are noting that passive detection from orbit is actually a more reliable measurement methodology than ground-based observation, because it can see the spatial pattern of the spoofing rather than just its local effects.
The AUR attacks are a different category of security story, closer to home for a significant fraction of the HN audience, which skews heavily toward Linux users. The AUR, or Arch User Repository, is a community-maintained package repository for Arch Linux. Unlike the official Arch repositories, OR packages are user-submitted and not formally reviewed by a security team. Users are expected to read the build scripts before installing. The LWN article describes a recent wave of attacks exploiting that trust model.
The AUR attack surface is well understood within the Arch community. The trade-off between package availability and security review has always been explicit. What made the recent attacks notable, based on the HN discussion, is the sophistication of the social engineering component. Attackers apparently took over legitimate, long-standing packages through maintainer account compromise or by submitting to packages that had been abandoned by their original maintainers. When a package has years of legitimate history and suddenly gets a malicious update, the read the PKG build defense becomes less effective because users may have established trust habits.
The court records piece from the EFF is raising a civil liberties and access to justice argument that the HN community clearly finds compelling. It scored nearly 400 points. The core argument is straightforward. Court records are public documents created and maintained by the judicial system, which exists as a public institution. Charging per-page fees or per-document fees to access these records creates a two-tier justice system where well-resourced parties, corporations with legal teams, wealthy individuals, have access to information that the average person cannot afford.
This is where I want to bring in a brief concept that's relevant here, because the court records discussion touches on monopoly and access in a very specific legal context. The PACER system, the Federal Court Records Database, operates as effectively the only way to access federal court documents electronically. And there's an antitrust dimension worth understanding. Under the Sherman Act, which is the foundational U.S. antitrust law passed in 1890, a monopoly isn't illegal in itself. What matters legally isn't just market share, it's whether the entity used its dominant position through exclusionary conduct to maintain or extend that dominance. Market share alone, even 100% of a market, doesn't constitute an antitrust violation. You have to show the mechanism of exclusion. The analogy I'd use is, if you make a genuinely better mousetrap and everyone buys it, you've monopolized the mousetrap market legally. If you buy up all the metal so competitors can't make mousetraps, that's the Sherman Act problem. In the PACER case, the argument isn't exactly antitrust, It's more a statutory and constitutional access to justice argument. But the underlying logic about government-controlled information access and the costs it imposes on people who need it runs parallel to how antitrust economists think about bottleneck access.
The EFF's position is essentially that digital reproduction of already created documents has near zero marginal cost, and the fee structure is therefore not recovering actual costs, but generating revenue, which is an inappropriate use of a public institution's monopoly over official records. Now, here's where I want to do something we should do more often, Marcus. Push back on a claim the HN community is pretty confident about. The consensus in today's feed, and particularly in the GPT 5.5 hallucination thread, is that open source models are on a clear convergence path with closed frontier models, and that the hallucination data is evidence of this.
I see the argument. GLM 5.2 performs better on factual recall in this benchmark. It's open source and MIT licensed, ergo the gap is closing and may even be reversing in some dimensions. What's the strongest counterargument?
The strongest counterargument is that we might be measuring the wrong things. Hallucination benchmarks test factual recall in structured evaluation settings, which is genuinely important but represents a narrow slice of what makes a frontier model useful in deployment. The capabilities that are hardest to measure: multi-step reasoning under ambiguity, code generation for novel architectures, consistent behavior across very long context windows, instruction following in edge cases. These may still favor models trained with significantly larger compute budgets and more sophisticated RLHF pipelines.
So the assumption that could be wrong is that benchmark parity on hallucination rates implies general capability parity.
Exactly. And there's a second assumption, that the MIT license means deployment parity. Even if GLM 5.2 is technically excellent, serving frontier-level inference at scale requires infrastructure investments, inference optimization, safety filtering, API reliability that most organizations can't replicate. The open source model being better on one metric doesn't mean the closed ecosystem advantage collapses.
Here's the concrete signal to watch for. If enterprise adoption of GLM 5.2 in production systems, not experimentation, actual production, reaches a meaningful fraction of GPT-5 API usage within the next 18 months, that would be genuine evidence that the open-closed gap is narrowing in the ways that matter economically. If it stays primarily in research and experimentation contexts, the benchmark data is interesting, but not yet decision-relevant for most organizations. The burden of proof for the open source's winning narrative should be deployment outcomes, not evaluation scores.